Well, thank you for that introduction. I'd like to, along with the other presenters, add my thanks to the conveners and the sponsors of this conference. If, as many of us hope to see, an increased interest in the biblical interpretation of this period begins to grow, I don't doubt that this conference will have been significant in stimulating some of that scholarly interest. In early 1685, Richard Baxter published his heavily annotated paraphrase on the New Testament, a work he had been engaged with for several decades. Already free on his own recognizance, having been arrested in November of 1684 for unlicensed preaching, Baxter was rearrested on the 28th of February, this time on the charge that his commentary in the paraphrase constituted seditious libel against the Church of England. He remained in prison this time. In June, the judge fined him 500 marks and remanded him to prison until the fine was paid. Baxter spent the next 18 months there, some 21 months all told, until his fine was remitted by the Catholic King James II in November of 1686. He is by now in his 70s, by the way. This image is arresting to the modern imagination, to be sure, in part because the element of religious and press censorship, but also in part because Bible commentary is not something we usually associate with tense political confrontation. It's difficult to exaggerate the degree of religious and political acrimony that characterized the decades after the Restoration, however, such that any and most every printed work was read through the lens of its implications for public life. Baxter's paraphrase is a case in point. The charge was provoked by the ominously surnamed Roger Lestrange. Lestrange had been surveyor of the press since 1663, using that office to spy out and impound unlicensed and heretical publications of nonconformists, as well as to subject authors, printers, and booksellers to legal harassment. And he had attacked Baxter in numerous publications of his own for the past 25 years. Just 3 days before Baxter's arrest, Lestrange declaimed against the paraphrase in the Observator, a weekly broadsheet that he published, quote, "Mr. Baxter has broken the truce. He preaches a new gospel, his paraphrase on the New Testament. The faction is restless and cruel." It was, he concluded, quote, "one of the boldest, the wickedest, the most scandalous and dangerous attempt upon the honor of the government I ever met with since I was born." At his trial, the judge attacked Baxter as, quote, "an old schismatical knave, a sniveling parson, a hypocritical villain." Nonconformists found themselves in a political and religious maelstrom in the wake of the Restoration. Their dream of a thorough reformation of the Church of England and the religious hegemony needed to effect it had foundered during the interregnum. Their post-restoration hope of a middle station in the form of a broad church version of national comprehension was extinguished in the wake of the failures of the Savoy Conference, 1661, and other such efforts at reconciliation. Having triumphed in their quest to control the direction of the restructuring of Anglicanism, high church clergy and their Tory allies in Parliament were in no mood to indulge nonconformity. Nonconformists thus found themselves in a seemingly untenable situation, asserting their ongoing loyalty to the state while dissenting from the religion of the state. Finding a middle ground, the ground of toleration for conscientious objection, and the concepts of religious liberty and pluralism needed to sustain it, was only accomplished painfully and slowly, and for those like Baxter, rather unwillingly. Not surprisingly, but not often appreciated, the circumstances required renewed attention to those passages in Scripture that spoke to the political posture of Christians. Thus, the biblical commentary of nonconformists on both sides of the Atlantic took on an urgent political function. This essay will examine the contours of that interpretive world, arguing that biblical commentary played a significant role in the emerging articulation of religious pluralism and tolerance in early modernity. For the purposes of this paper, I'll be examining the commentary of Richard Baxter and Cotton Mather, two proto-evangelicals whose devotional writings were profoundly influential on early evangelicalism and pietism. In the published version of this paper, I'm going to include figures like Matthew Poole and Matthew Henry. There's just not enough time or room to do that today. As a precursor for what I'm going to say next, there are about a dozen texts that seem to become key texts for people struggling with this problem or trying to address this problem. So they come up over and over again, and I'll just sort of list them. Again, I said about a dozen. The passages in 1 and 2 Samuel that deal with David and his relationships with Saul and his refusal to be a regicide. The gospel passages about paying tribute to Caesar. The apostolic refusal to submit to the Sanhedrin in Acts chapter 5. And of course, most importantly, the apostolic teachings found in Romans chapter 13 and 1 Peter chapter 2. The onset of the Reformation provoked acute questions concerning political authority. Countering claims of authenticity by Protestant churches and the papacy, the oscillating religious affiliations of monarchs and the people they ruled, and a growing interest in the rights of citizens coalesced around a renewed interest as to what constituted legitimate authority and when or whether any political authority could be resisted. Political theorizing inevitably meant resorting to scripture for precedent and permission to act. The magisterial reformers reaffirmed the imperative of Christian submission to recognize political authority as divinely instituted as a divinely instituted entity, though they did so with considerable finesse given the political complexities of the time. John Calvin, for example, sought to find a pathway between scriptural admonitions towards submission on the one hand and abject political servility on the other, setting the tone in turn for many English Protestants. In his commentary on Romans 13, Calvin affirmed that rulers come to power through divine agency. All rulers, no matter how they have come to power, rule as those appointed by God. Thus, to resist them is to resist God. However, Calvin also gave attention to the obligation that rulers had toward justice. They cannot act simply out of self-interest. They are, quote, responsible to God and to men in the exercise of their power. Government is established by God to provide justice and order, to protect the good and restrain the wicked. Rulers who fail to do this, who fail in this responsibility, implicitly lose their divine sanction and thus their right to command submission. Quote, tyrannies and the unjust exercise of power, as they are full of disorder, are not an ordained government. In his Institutes, Calvin went even further. The ideal form of government is not monarchy, let alone absolute monarchy, but rather that of the original Hebrew constitution, quote, an aristocracy bordering on democracy. The happiest society is one where freedom is regulated with becoming moderation and is properly established on a durable basis. For this task, an aristocratic democracy, quote, far excels all others. It is true that Christian citizens owe allegiance even to unjust rulers, but this allegiance is radically qualified. It extends only so far as they are not asked to disobey God's commands. Furthermore, Christian magistrates, in their roles as governing authorities, have a duty to restrain the wickedness of those above them in government, even and especially the tyranny of kings. God uses avengers from among his servants to punish wicked rulers and to break, quote, the bloody scepters of arrogant kings. God acts through them to overturn intolerable governments. Reformers such as Calvin thus provided ammunition, both to those who wish to maintain the political status quo, as well as to those who wish to overthrow it. Political judgments about the relative justice of any particular government, its conformity to God's revealed will, the appropriate form of subjection to it, and the proper means to resist injustice were violently contested for the next 2.5 centuries. In England, early Protestant views on political authority aimed at suppressing Catholicism found a potent vehicle for dissemination in the liturgical anthology, Certain Sermons and Homilies, dated 1547, developed, written, and published under the aegis of Archbishop Thomas Cranmer. The Book of Homilies was created to provide all clergy in the Church of England, but particularly the more rustic ones, with a corpus of material for preaching that would articulate the cardinal teachings of Reformed theology and morality. Clergy were required to read these sermons verbatim during the liturgy, and to read them to the exclusion of all other sermons. With only 12 homilies in the original work, this meant that parishioners would hear each sermon, about 4 times a year. A second book of homilies treating the liturgy was appended to this in 1563, so it expanded considerably after that. The 35th of the 39 articles requires their reading by all subscribing clergy. The 36th article enumerates the titles of the homilies that must be read. After the Book of Common Prayer, the Book of Homilies has been judged to have been as well-known and as influential as any writings produced by the Church between 1547 and 1640. The title of the 10th homily is An Exhortation Concerning Good Order and Obedience to Rulers and Magistrates. Appearing during the tenuous reign of Edward VI, it amplified the positions on political submission found in the likes of Calvin, while muting provisions for civil resistance. It also heightened the stakes involved by making resistance a soteriological issue. Quote, all persons having souls do owe a bound duty, and even in conscience, obedience, submission, and subjection to the higher powers. St. Paul threatens no less pain than everlasting damnation to all disobedient persons. In 1570, a second sermon on submission was appended to this collection, entitled A Homily Against Disobedience and Willful Rebellion. Published as a response to the Catholic Rebellion in the North against Queen Elizabeth in 1569, the tone of this homily was exceedingly strident, even bordering on panicked, perhaps understandably given the circumstances. The most significant rhetorical direction taken in this homily is to locate all acts of rebellion in primordial time, in the Garden of Eden. Quote, thus became rebellion both the first and greatest, and the very root of all other sins, and the first and principal cause both of all worldly and bodily miseries, sorrows, diseases, sicknesses, and deaths, and which is infinitely worse than all these, the very cause of death and damnation eternal also. Rebellion was a demonic work. The devil is the first author and founder of rebellion. It is he who doth chiefly use the stirring up of subjects to rebel against their lawful princes. In time, both Elizabeth and James I would use the Book of Homilies to suppress Puritan ecclesial and political agitation as well. And for dissenters, it came to symbolize much of what was wrong with the Via Media. 4 new editions would appear after the Restoration, as the Anglican Church sought to solidify its supremacy over English religious life. The decades after the Restoration were a toxic brew of recrimination and score settling among English co-religionists. Anglican clergy and their allies in Parliament passed a series of laws meant to punish those who had taken part in the rebellion with the intent of exterminating nonconformist religion in any form. Opposition to the Church of England was equated with opposition to the crown. In succession, the Corporation Act, the Act of Uniformity, the Conventicles Act, and the 5 Mile Act required political office holders to be communicants in the church, clergy to conform to the Book of Common Prayer, banned nonconformist gatherings of more than 5 people. I have an interesting anecdote about that. And banned ejected clergy from living within 5 miles of their former parishes. The Test Act of 1673 excluded non-communicants from military leadership as well. In addition, the Licensing Act, 1662, censored non-conformist publications. The fines for violations of these laws were often deliberately punitive and in some cases ruinous. Prison terms were often the only alternative for those without sufficient means. Baxter's annotations on Romans 13 are some of the most extensive in his paraphrase. In addition to his transliterative comments, he appended an additional section of notes centered around 15 questions in which he specifies the relationship between resistance or liberty of conscience and subjection. In contrast to the Book of Homilies, he shifts the emphasis away from the authority of rulers and towards the accountability that rulers have to God. Political authority is derived authority, thus God has bound rulers, quote, as his officers, to see to the execution of his universal laws. And therefore, their office and authority received from God is not to be persecutors, but to punish the evil. Rulers are not, quote, authorized to destroy or to do mischief, but to take care of the common welfare. As those appointed by God, rulers are due the allegiance of their subjects. Baxter specifically rules out rebellion. In his commentary on verse 7, render therefore to all their dues, his paraphrase eliminates the interpretive possibility that some rulers might not be owed any dues, and therefore could be targeted for removal. Quote, I am not persuading you to own usurpation, but that you give all their proper due. Baxter takes pains, however, to point out that subjection is not to be equated with unflinching servility. Christians, quote, must not obey a sinful command. Their subjection in such cases is to suffer the consequences of their disobedience. Thus, he makes room for liberty of conscience. It can and must be asserted, but the consequences for doing so must not be avoided. The conscience of a citizen is sacrosanct and belongs to God. His body, however, belongs to some extent to the state. That said, what is perhaps most striking about Baxter's commentary is the great emphasis he places on the political agency of citizens, and along with that, the right to resist. These are first rooted in the uncertainty involving, and thus the necessity of rendering judgment, concerning the political realm. For Baxter, even recognizing a proper claim to the right to rule is a speculative one. It cannot be based on the form of government, since this is an indifferent matter. It cannot be based on the succession of rulers or on the gifts of leadership. Thus is it up to the common people, quote, to judge as far as they can know, else they cannot tell whom to obey or defend. So Baxter places a responsibility on the citizenry to the best of their abilities, determine who the proper ruler is. And if they aren't given that right, then they don't know who to obey. So there's judgment involved on the part of the citizenry. In some sense, then, the vulgar, and this is a quote, the vulgar are made judges of the prince's right. There's also an element of providence involved. If rulers have achieved power and are ruling justly, then it is reasonable, Baxter thinks, to assume that they are there by God's hand, and thus relieving pressure from the vulgar to rush to judgment. Ideally, providence also has a proper political mechanism associated with it. Those present at the founding of a government must consent to the form and person so established. Quote, God's providence doth so manage the affairs of the world as shall point out the man or families that the people should accept of first while free, as qualified by strength, wisdom, and goodness for authority. But all of this shall be by a free people chosen. I know, therefore, no remaining title but the mutual consent of persons made capable by the providence of God at the forming of the government. Thus, there's a strong element in Baxter's thought of the idea of a social contract, a key element in early modern political theory, and a concept that depended on consent, and thus was implicitly dependent on the right to withhold that consent in certain cases. Baxter's absolute insistence that the people have a natural God or God-given right and duty to judge whether magistrates, including bishops, are in fact ruling justly certainly implies that there's a line which, if crossed, could necessitate action which might be termed treasonous, civil disobedience in matters of religion. His insistence that people cannot be imposed upon religiously without their free consent made the prospect of a comprehensive national church of the sort envisioned by his critics all but impossible. Conscientious objection would always result in a certain level of social unrest and disorder, that is, religious pluralism, however modest this might be. The live questions, of course, were whether and at what point the strictures of Anglicanism would necessitate civil disobedience, who would be competent to decide this, and how such would be implemented, questioned Baxter, perhaps conveniently, leaves unanswered. Now, a charitable reading of Baxter's commentary on Romans 13 might conclude that he was merely creating space for the consciences of nonconformists in a time of persecution. As citizens, they must be subject to the monarch. Yet as conscientious Christians, they must resist those elements of the state and the state's church that ran counter to their understanding of the faith. Critics like Lestrange, however, were hardly in a charitable frame of mind. At Baxter's trial, he identified 7 offending passages from the Gospels and Acts that libeled Anglican bishops. In addition, a certain noted clergyman, left unnamed in the trial proceedings, raised, quote, some accusations out of Romans 13 as against the king to touch his life. The passages in question all come out of, again, the Gospels and then Acts 15, are generally those detailing conflicts between Jesus and the Pharisees. Baxter's annotations on these passages take issue with clergy who restrain unfettered preaching of the gospel. Of course, something that had been going on, nonconformists couldn't get licenses to preach, and so he is, in a sense, taking a rather direct shot at the Church of England. His accusers read these veiled passages, labeled innuendo, as references to Anglican bishops. His lawyers objected that without having identified specific bishops by name, or even bishops in general, a word Baxter does not use in his commentary, such inferences failed to meet the legal bar of libel, an assertion that did not carry the day. Lestrange read Baxter's commentary through the lens of the Puritan Rebellion, now 5 decades past, but still vividly resented. Lestrange himself had taken up the Royalist cause during the Civil War and narrowly avoided execution in 1644. He went into exile from 1653 to 1660. He never forgave the authors of the rebellion and bitterly pursued nonconformists of all stripes as rebels and regicides. His doggedness in hounding his victims made him notorious, earning him a place in John Bunyan's novel, The Holy War, dated 1682. I can't help but laugh when I see this, as the character Mr. Filth. In Bunyan's words, an odious, nasty, lascivious piece of beastliness. No reason to pull your punches. Lestrange seems to have had Baxter particularly in his sights. Baxter in many ways represented all that was objectionable in the nonconformists, although perhaps somewhat undeservedly. When Baxter was driven out of his parish in 1641 for his Puritan sympathies, he rather incidentally became a chaplain in Cromwell's army. He objected to the regicide and as well as Cromwell's leadership. For example, he refused to become Cromwell's chaplain. He supported the restoration of the monarchy, was named a chaplain to Charles II, was licensed to preach in London, and was named to the Royal Commission aimed at religious reconciliation through national comprehension in 1661, the so-called Savoy Conference. Yet none of this rendered him tolerable to Lestrange. A particular focus of his rage appears to have been Baxter's political treatise, A Holy Commonwealth, published in 1659. Written at a time when the forces of revolution were reaching the point of exhaustion, Baxter sought to offer a way forward that provided for the kind of government that would support his vision of a thoroughly reformed church. It contains all of the arguments that appear in his annotations on the Epistle to the Romans, perhaps most notably the right to resist for reasons of conscience. The consciences of men are out of reach, that's a quote of Baxter, of the judgment of magistrates. Thus, all tolerable differences among honest men on religious matters must be endured. Baxter clearly anticipated that he and his fellow nonconformists might be marginalized in the new regime, even as he argued for national comprehension, a hope he held out for until his dying day. If arguing for the right to resist was not sufficiently objectionable, Baxter also used the long preface of this work, The Holy Commonwealth, to rehash the history of the Civil War, a retelling that defended the actions of those implicated in the rebellion, such as himself. Thus, the work was read by royalists as an unremorseful apologetic for all the misfortunes the nation had experienced during the war. The work became so controversial that in 1670, Baxter issued a repudiation of his own work in print, simply to call off the dogs. But this so-called repudiation, he describes it as something that retracted none of the doctrine. Baxter was simply repenting, this is another quote, repenting of the writing of the book as an infelicity, and that is which did no good but hurt. Merely a concession to, quote, the incessant bloody malice of the reproachers. So it wasn't much of an apology. In fact, Lestrange drew the connection directly between the treason defended by Baxter in his Holy Commonwealth and the treason implied in his paraphrase in his charging critique. This is a quote of the arresting charge against Baxter. This same paraphrase of Mr. Baxter's upon the New Testament is a provocation that would make a saint swear like a soldier, a violation of all the terms and measures of good manners, society, and religion. In his Holy Commonwealth, he did prettily well towards the hindering of the late king's restoration, as he had done formerly towards his banishment, and before that also towards the deposing and murdering of his royal and blessed father. His Commonwealth aphorisms are no better than downright casuistical treason. The paraphrase shares this fundamental fault. Its main aim is to, quote, to make broad signs to the people that they are under a persecuting and a superstitious government. Kings and bishops are equally anti-Christian to him. St. Baxter does nothing if he is not a lash at church governors. He thus makes our church governors to be perverters of the gospel and then bids the people reject and forsake them as such, wherein he makes the people judges and our ecclesiastical rulers offenders. What seems to have been the breaking point for Lestrange and his collaborators was the fact that by insinuating his political theory into Scripture, Baxter was leading unsuspecting readers to conclude that his paraphrastic interpretation was to be equated with the literal meaning of the text. Quote, but when he comes to turn the word of God upon us and to bring the four evangelists and St. Paul to subscribe to the divine rights of rebellion and schism, there's no more to be said in it but the putting of it to the vote. Lestrange championed the claim that any expression of religious dissent was a form of sedition against the political arrangement of England, as it raised doubts about the national church headed and supported by the monarchy. Thus, the civil disobedience of nonconformists and the literature they produced justifying this was inherently treasonous. The assertion of liberty of conscience was a sham intended to buy time for plotting further rebellion. In this case, by the very patriarch of schism, quote, the seducer in the shape of a godly minister. If such liberty were unleashed, it would produce social chaos, since personal autonomy would trump the rule of law. The only way towards civil order was to silence and imprison dissenters. Toleration of religious pluralism, especially extending it to those who had criminally participated in the previous rebellion, was a non sequitur. Dissenters, he writes, are like insects, which must be eliminated in order for the gardens of monarchy and episcopacy to flourish. The political controversies of post-Restoration England, of course, also flowed into the colony. So now I'm going to make a transition to the New World, talk about Cotton Mather. Yes, the tie is gone. At the outset of his professional life, Cotton Mather was involved in one of the signal political controversies in 17th century New England. In the contention over the legal status of the colony that played out between 1684 and 1691, Mather took a leading and very public role. He had a hand in the anonymous publication of his father's brief discourse concerning the unlawfulness of common prayer worship, 1687. A recitation of all of the complaints against Anglican liturgy that Richard Baxter and other nonconformists had been making for three decades. This polemic was directed against the Anglican services being newly held at South Church under the patronage of the recently appointed royal governor, Edmund Andrus, an act for which Andrus would issue a warrant of libel against Mather 2 years later. In the immediate aftermath of the Glorious Revolution, Mather delivered a sermon, this is April 1689, intimating his support for the overthrow of James II, and by implication, his royal representatives in New England. Just days later, Andrus sought to arrest Mather on the aforementioned charge of libel, the same day that the colonists began their own revolution. Mather met with the chief men of Boston that morning. By noon, their declaration of the gentleman in favor of removing the now former king's men from power was read in public, very probably by Mather himself, who seems to have had a key role in the writing of the document as well. In the ensuing months, Mather preached and published in support of the colonists' actions. For all these goings-on, he was later described by Andrus and Edmund Randolph as one of the chief designers of the revolt, actively giving orders to others involved. Among royalist sympathizers, he became known as the Young Pope and was pilloried by them to the political classes in England for his anti-Anglican and anti-monarchical sentiments. Now, the history of the Mather family was intimately tied to the events of the Restoration, to the nonconformist community there, and to leaders such as Richard Baxter. After receiving his MA from Trinity College in 1658, Increase Mather served two parishes and one military chaplaincy in England over the next 3 years. He fled to New England in 1661 when his outspoken nonconformity made it untenable for him to remain. But nonconformists in New England faced a different set of political questions in the late 17th century as they sought to come to terms with the aftermath of the Restoration, since they had, in fact, achieved the kind of reform of the English church that Puritans like Baxter had failed to accomplish, as well as the political control necessary to enforce it. Understandably, they were not initially interested in developing strong theories of resistance and liberty of conscience. This state of affairs began to erode immediately after Charles II's accession, however, beginning with the mission of the King's Royal Commissioners in 1664 and continued on through the 1670s, and concluding with the revocation of the charter by James II in 1684. The revocation deeply split the citizens of New England. The Mathers from the outset led the party of resistance, which would reach its full fruition 5 years later. Increase Mather publicly proclaimed that submission to this act would be a sin against God and persuaded the citizenry to reject the crown's interference. But when he returned to London in 1688 to negotiate a new charter with James II, his tone had markedly changed. Instead of pleading for a return to the status quo ante, he petitioned the king for toleration and liberty of conscience in New England. The new charter, 1691, did in fact force the introduction of Anglicanism proper and enforce a broad religious pluralism in New England, bringing the experiences and interests of New World Puritans into closer alignment with their nonconformist brethren back in England. From now on, their religious fortunes would be dictated by the crown and by Parliament. Mather owned and employed the biblical commentaries of Baxter, Matthew Poole, Matthew Henry in the Biblia Americana. His professional life would also become linked to both Baxter and Henry through correspondence and favors that they did for him. Yet his commentary on the passages related to submission and resistance is markedly different from both. When Mather began, this is a little textual construction note, but it's important to the story. When Mather began the Biblia in 1693, he constructed notebooks of blank sheets to record his commentary, a practice that was typical of the time. The original notebooks were octavo in size, as the pattern of the chapter headings seems to indicate. He initially allotted himself 1 to 2 sheets of paper, that is 2 to 4 pages of space for commentary, for each chapter in a given biblical book, penciling in the chapter headings before he began introducing notes to them. So he anticipated, I'm going to give this much space to each chapter, and it usually ran 2 to 4 pages. Since he with some frequency omitted chapter headings altogether, it appears that in the initial stage of composition, he planned to skip certain chapters that did not hold interest for him and presumably for his anticipated audience. Mather's initial plan proved to be short-sighted, however, and as time went by, he began to assert additional leaves for various chapters, including those previously omitted, as necessity dictated. It is worth noting, then, that of the 11 passages typically employed to address the issue of submission and resistance, 5 of these were later inserts, and 1 is completely absent. He never addresses it at all. It is difficult to imagine that Mather would have incidentally omitted so many passages that spoke to one of the most pressing political issues of his day, passages that were directly relevant to his own political biography, and passages that would have been of intense interest to any reader. Of the 10 passages that received commentary, that is, the 5 original inserts that he had put into the book, as well as these 5 later additions that come in, 8 of these 10 passages don't contain any relevant comments on the key verses. In 2 of these 8, there's no direct comment at all. For example, on the 2nd chapter of 1 Peter, Matthew comments on verses 2, 3, 5, 9, and 16, 24, and 25, but passes over verse 13 entirely. In the other 6 of these 8 passages, the commentary most often focuses on their least notable features or minimizes their political significance. For example, when David strikes down the Amalekite who reports Saul's death to him, rather than taking David's action to be evidence of his consciousness of the inviolability of the king's person, as would be the common interpretation, Mather chooses instead to focus on how the Amalekite would have known it was Saul in the first place, given that the king would have exchanged his royal robes for military clothing in battle. In his commentary on Matthew 22, he simply offers a short and sweet gloss on Jesus' words, "Render unto Caesar," citing Tertullian, "Give the man to God and the penny to Caesar. The man bears God's image as the penny did Caesar's. Where God and Caesar are in opposition, the whole man is God's right." His comments on Acts 5 border on the dismissive, regarding the apostles' assertion that they must obey God rather than men, typically read in Protestantism as a confirmation of the right to resist religious tyranny. Mather describes it as merely, quote, "a maxim so evident to the natural conscience of man that even a pagan long before this had raised it." Thus, Mather seems to have studiously avoided providing commentary on nearly the entire range of these politically significant passages. First, omitting them from his plan altogether, then either avoiding any comment in later assertions or making rather irrelevant or innocuous comments when he chose to weigh in. And one can understand why this might be so. On the one hand, he would have had no interest in stoking dissent from the traditional New England arrangement by schismatics such as Quakers and Baptists. Alternatively, he would have had even less interest in calling attention to his own recent political notoriety under the conditions of the new charter. Yet everything about his actions surrounding the political turmoil of 1689 makes it unlikely that his commentary would have commended abject submission either. He also had to consider that his most anticipated readership of the Biblia would have been in England and not in the colonies. The parties of this sharply divided anticipated audience would have respectively found strong calls to resistance or submission obnoxious, depending on which side of the fence they fell on. Mather seems to have chosen the route of avoiding any substantive comment on the issues, as though such political concerns were hardly worth anyone's attention. Ah, there's my page. It seems likely, then, that Mather would also take into account the uncertain circumstances that dissenters continued to face in the early 18th century. While the immediate and most onerous persecution of nonconformists came to a close with the accession of William and Mary in the Act of Toleration, 1689, the underlying animus against and efforts to suppress them continued to simmer, making the security of their religious liberty an uncertain thing. With the death of William III in 1702, for example, mobs attacked and destroyed churches of dissenters. And it wasn't until the Riot Act of 1715, nearly 13 years later, that such activity was made illegal. In addition, Queen Anne was deeply committed to high church Anglicanism and thus to suppressing the dissenters. Though she promised to maintain the Act of Toleration, she did so with significant qualifications. Upon her accession, the occasional conformity bill was introduced, requiring nonconformists to take communion according to Anglican rites at regular intervals. The bill also required public office holders not to attend a nonconformist church in the 12 months before their appointment. Under the old Corporation Act, which required that office holders be Anglican communicants, nonconformists had been taking communion once, just prior to election, and then never again. The new bill fined them for such behavior and required their continued communion on pain of loss of the office. In addition, politicians of the era spoke openly against dissenters. Sir Humphrey Mackworth, for example, advocated their complete exclusion from office in his 1703 essay defending the Occasional Conformity Bill. Anglican bishops and clergies continued to excoriate dissenters from pulpits and in the press. None was more notorious than Henry Sacheverell. Though he came from a family with long and deep roots in Puritanism, his grandfather Henry was a signatory to Charles I's execution, ironically. Sacheverell became such a high churchman that he was impeached in 1709 for declaring the Glorious Revolution to be illegal. In the decade prior to this, however, he had favorably distinguished himself by his vitriol against dissenters. His 1702 sermon, The Political Union, labeled them as enemies of the union of church and state, urging his sympathetic readers to, quote, hang out the bloody flag and banner of defiance towards them. He openly promoted anti-dissenter conspiracy theories such as the Church in Danger Scare, 1705 to 1706, and the sermon for which he was ultimately impeached, The Perils of False Brethren, was a three-hour harangue against dissenters. In sum, Mather had many reasons to restrain his political views within his biblical commentary. There is, however, one passage in which Mather allowed his political sympathies to show, the 13th chapter of Romans. Mather has three separate entries on the first verse, which is, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers." The first of these entries would have been written fairly early. It's numbered 2362, which probably places it around 1698 to 99. It contains a citation of the Portuguese Jesuit missionary Antonio Fernandez's commentary on the Old Testament to the effect that the thrust of this verse is to affirm not just that humans owe their submission to rulers, but that rulers too, as those, quote, possessing souls, are themselves subject to authority. There are higher powers whereto the magistrates themselves are to be subject. The highest on earth must be subject to the Most High God of heaven. Thus, Mather's first comment on this passage is to assert that even kings are subject to higher authorities, and thus not absolute in their authority over their subjects. Mather's second entry is unnumbered. It's a citation of John Locke's paraphrase and notes on the epistles of St. Paul, which were published between 1705 and 1707. For reasons I don't have time to go into here, it seems reasonable to me to suppose that this entry should be dated sometime between 1708 and 1710. In his treatment of Romans 13, Locke focuses on several key ideas, all of which have their origins in his two treatises on government. First, being a part of God's kingdom does not absolve Christians from being subject to earthly rulers, even ungodly heathen rulers. At the same time, being Christians does not prevent them from asserting their rights as citizens. Quote, from those due rights which by the law of nature or the constitutions of their country belonged to them. Furthermore, Paul takes the opportunity in this passage to offer a universal theology of government, according to Locke, one that explains, quote, whence all magistrates everywhere have their authority and for what end they have it and should use it, in order to make the point that civil authority derives from God. As such, all earthly rulers are obligated to act according to divine justice, severely limiting their capriciousness. Government must operate according to, quote, the end for which God gave it, that is, the good of the people, sincerely pursued according to the best of the skill of those who share that power. Only under these conditions are rulers, quote, not to be resisted. In Locke's hands, the 13th chapter of Romans becomes not a call to political passivity, but rather a bold assertion in defense of the rights of citizens to determine their own political destiny. Mather's excerpt of Locke keys in on those claims having the most radical implications. First, that while Christians qua Christians must not resist civil authorities, it seems, quote, as if the apostle meant here only magistrates having and exercising a lawful power. Furthermore, while Christians do not have exceptional rights, neither are they deprived of any right. Quote, they had the common right of others, their fellow citizens. Finally, and perhaps most significantly, Mather highlights Locke's most provocative point in his annotations. While speaking of paying tribute, the apostle, quote, enjoins render to all their dues, but who it was and to whom any of these or any dues of right belonged, he decides not. For that he leaves them to be determined by the laws and constitutions of their country. Mather follows Locke in asserting that the form of government, who is to be recognized as the proper authority, is, theologically speaking, arbitrary and indifferent, and something to be determined by the people of a particular country. Now, Mather extended this entry at a later date, taking direct aim at the kind of abject political slavishness advocated in the Book of Homilies, one I believe that probably dates from around 1714 to 1716. In 1708, Bishop George Bull directed Anglican clergy to once again begin using the homilies in their services. In 1713, Bishop Gilbert Burnet advocated the publication of a revised edition of the homilies, which came out in the same year, comprised of 62 sermons. Coming on the heels of the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts' decade-long push to settle a bishop in the colonies, ongoing since 1704, one can understand Mather's consternation about what the publication of the new edition of the homilies might have signaled. Citing an unnamed source, and if anybody can identify that source, I'd be grateful, Mather complains, "What if the clergy of England in the Book of Homilies did strain the text a little too far in showing of their extraordinary respect to King Edward VI and to Queen Elizabeth? Why should we keep it still upon the strain and not suffer it to come to itself by its own elastic motion?" Thus, Mather suggests the best way to interpret Paul's requirement of obedience is to see it simply as a reminder about the divine authority of government, rather than as a call to blind subservience, and as Mather sharply notes, one that only entails submission to an authority constrained by its divine purpose, quote, the security and peace of all its subjects. Mather's exposition of Romans 13 is thoroughly in keeping with his sentiments and activities at the time of the Glorious Revolution. The Declaration of the Gentlemen, crafted by Mather on the day of the revolt, articulates the conflict as one in which the just rights of citizens are being deprived by unjust authorities. Mather articulated the rationale for the political revolution in which he took part in terms of the kind of social contract theory typical of Locke and other early modern political theorists. By violating the rights of citizens, the governor had, in Lockean parlance, introduced a state of lawlessness in society. Under such circumstances, citizens had the right and even the duty to remove them as an act of self-defense in order to restore order upon which a just society, a divinely prescribed society, is predicated. His commentary on Romans 13 is in keeping with this understanding. Why then did Mather wait so long to express himself politically in the Biblia, or conversely, why did he allow his political ideas to see daylight at all in his commentary on Romans 13? Perhaps the passing of time emboldened him. Perhaps the uncertain ecclesiastical climate and the encroachment of Anglicanism in the colonies in the early 18th century alarmed him enough to speak out. Alternatively, should this entry date from the time after Queen Anne's death in 1714, it may reflect a lessened concern for discretion, given George I's sympathetic treatment of nonconformists. Or perhaps, since by this time his expectation of publication had all but disappeared, the Biblia may have become a forum where he could give voice to his true political sentiments without fear of discovery or reprisal. Whatever the case, Mather's biblical commentary offers scholars a potentially fruitful avenue, and this would apply to Baxter as well, of course, for understanding the development of early modern political thought. It provides further evidence, in Cotton Mather's case, that Locke's influence in the colonies began well in advance of the revolutionary period. One suspects that Mather was hardly the only figure of his time to have been absorbing such ideas? So we could ask ourselves a question, in what other sermons or commentary notebooks might early modern political influences be found? In conclusion, biblical interpretation was not merely a platform in this era for abstract theological speculation or for purely religious concerns. It could and did serve, as I've tried to show here, and as I think Dr. Neely's lecture this morning indicated, biblical interpretation was an important instrument for processing social change and conflict. It could and did serve as an instrument for considering political concerns in the late 17th and early 18th centuries, particularly for nonconformists whose opportunities for religious expression were severely circumscribed for nearly half a century after the Restoration. Through their reflection on Scripture, they were able to give voice to their discontent, to make sense of their political and social marginalization, and to begin to construct an alternative vision of Christian faith attuned to the principle of long-suffering in the face of persecution. It is no coincidence, as scholars have observed, that nonconformists began to turn inward in their theology towards affective or heart religion as they sought to come to terms with the loss of external or societal markers of true religion, such as the state church. From here, it was but a short step towards the revivalism of the succeeding generation. Thank you.